Thanks for tuning in for the July 20th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals. In this week's feature interview, Dr. Jessica Magid Bernstein discusses the symptoms of and incidence of hospitalization in patients with reversible cerebrovascular vasoconstriction syndrome in the United States. In our What's Trending segment, you'll hear from Dr. Seeman Chaturvedi on new strategies to prevent stroke in patients with atrial fibrillation.
Hi, this is Will Rondo. I'm a PA at Leahy Clinic outside of Boston, and I have the pleasure of interviewing Jessica Magid Bernstein, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Neurology at Yale. She is a lead author of a paper titled Reversible Cerebral Vasoconstriction Syndrome, Symptoms, Incidence, and Resource Utilization in a Population-Based U.S. Cohort, published in this week's Neurology. Thanks for speaking with me. Why don't we start with an overview of RCVS for our listeners?
Thanks so much for having me. So RCVS, as some people might know, stands for Reversible Cerebral Vasoconstriction Syndrome. And this actually used to be sort of several separate diagnoses that were, over the past several decades, considered to be one condition that was named RCVS. And this includes Kall-Flemming syndrome, migrainous vasospasm, benign angiopathy of the CNS, postpartum angiopathy, and drug-induced arteritis. And RCVS is diagnosed clinically, but also angiographically. So patients often present with a headache, usually described as a thunderclap headache, and sometimes a recurrent thunderclap headache. And then the RCVS is confirmed angiographically, where you see multifocal segmental cerebral artery vasoconstriction, but it also requires no evidence of an aneurysm or other vascular malformation, a normal or near normal CSF profile, and reversibility of the angiographic findings within 12 weeks. And this obviously is why it's called reversible cerebral vasoconstriction syndrome. You know, it is important that we note that this is one of the causes of thunderclap headaches, especially recurrent thunderclap headaches, and also a cause of cortical subarach, because that will help people keep it in their differential when they're seeing patients presenting with those conditions.
Got it. And that's subarachnoid hemorrhage, right?
Yeah.
Got it. So tell us about the take-home messages from your study.
So we performed a retrospective cohort study, and it had two different parts. So the first part was to validate the use of the ICD-10 code for RCVS. And this is because there actually was no ICD-9 code for this condition. And then used this code and used administrative claims data to estimate the incidence of hospitalizations for RCVS in the US. And we found that age and sex standardized incidence for hospitalizations for RCVS in US adults was about 3 per million per year. And I know that that estimate sounds low, but I think really it's important to understand that we also looked at associated conditions. And even though many people have a benign course, there is a non-trivial amount of patients who have severe sequelae. And so it's really important, as I mentioned, that we really keep this on our differential so that we don't miss patients who have serious cases of RCVS.
And I think one of the limitations you noted in your paper was you didn't get as many Western states. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So unfortunately, we're limited to which states provide this data, and we were able to get all 11 states that provide the longitudinal data. And it was relatively well distributed across the country, but less Western states than other regions.
Got it. Okay. And so you folks looked at claims for RCVS, but then further validated them with the RCVS2 score. Could you remind us about this score and how to use it?
This score is pretty easy to calculate. I don't know if people use it all the time, but it's well validated, previously published in Neurology, and very easy to use. And so the score ranges from -2 up to 10, and patients get points for a thunderclap headache, identification of a vasoconstrictive trigger, which is a risk factor for RCVS, sex, and also presence of subarachnoid hemorrhage on imaging. And they lose points for intracerebral artery involvement, because that's less commonly associated with the vasoconstriction in RCVS. So a score of less than or equal to 2 would not be consistent with a diagnosis of RCVS. A score of 3 or 4 is equivocal, and a score of greater than or equal to 5 is diagnostic with a very high sensitivity and specificity of 90% and 99%. And this is when compared to gold standard diagnostic criteria.
Okay, thanks for that. So given what was found, should our practices change around how we initially observe or treat patients presenting with RCVS?
So, you know, I think, as I mentioned earlier, this is still a rare condition, but one of the problems is likely that some people don't think about this condition when they're seeing patients. And so I think one of the major changes that in impacts of this study and other studies of RCVS could be that neurologists should really have this on their differential when they're working up patients, especially patients who come in with a thunderclap headache and patients who have cortical subarachnoid hemorrhage, where they don't have evidence of a vascular malformation or trauma, something to think about. And also it should probably trigger neurologists and other people who are working up these patients in that setting to appropriately monitor them and also to definitely get vessel imaging, because you want to see the vasoconstriction and the severity and diffuseness of the vasoconstriction to help you manage these patients. And like I mentioned earlier, many of the patients have a benign course, but not all of them. We saw relatively, you know, reasonable percentages in the teens and 20s of patients who have ischemic stroke during that admission, who have intracerebral hemorrhage, subarachnoid hemorrhage, seizures. And so it's very important that some of these patients can have a more serious course and they should probably be monitored more closely. Also, I think it is important. We looked at patients' admissions and ED presentations prior to the patient's admission for RCVS, and almost 40% of the patients presented to the ED with a headache diagnosis within 90 days before their diagnosis, and almost 10% of them were admitted for some other neurologic diagnoses in that same time period. So while we can't definitively draw conclusions from this type of study, that probably indicates that some people were not observed inpatient for the appropriate amount of time or were incorrectly diagnosed when they first presented. And that's really important because this is something that we should have in our minds so we don't miss people with this diagnosis.
And anything else you'd like to add that might be helpful for our listeners?
You know, the only other thing that I just wanted to talk about a little bit that is not a, you know, a direct focus of this paper, but I think it's important when we're thinking about patients who do present with RCVS is that, you know, the management isn't very standardized. And as many people know, it's usually just supportive care, but some people do have a more severe course, and I hope that, you know, studies in the future are able to identify risk factors for people who might have the more severe sequelae so we can appropriately triage who should be hospitalized for longer periods of time, who should be more closely observed, who may need additional imaging, and also to make sure that if people have a really severe vasospasm course, which is probably the most high-risk subset of patients, they may need interventional treatment, just like subarachnoid hemorrhage patients, including, you know, even intra-arterial vasospasm treatment with verapamil if they have refractory vasospasm and they're having, you know, ischemic strokes as a result of that.
Thanks again, Jessica. This is Will Rondo here with the Neurology Podcast. I've just had the pleasure of interviewing Jessica Magid-Bernstein, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Neurology at Yale, on her paper titled Reversible Cerebral Vasoconstriction Syndrome, Symptoms, Incidence, and Resource Utilization in a Population-Based U.S. Cohort, published in this week's Neurology.
Hi, everyone. This is Andy Sutherland from the University of Virginia. And for this week's Neurology Podcast, What's Trending segment, I have the immense pleasure of speaking with my friend and colleague, Seemant Chaturvedi from the University of Maryland. We're going to be discussing a paper published in the April 2021 issue of the journal Stroke titled New Avenues for Optimal Treatment of Atrial Fibrillation and Stroke Prevention. In this up-to-date review, Seemant and colleagues highlight recent advances and ongoing clinical questions that are relevant for the management of patients with stroke related to atrial fibrillation, which is obviously something that we as neurologists encounter quite frequently. So, Seemant, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Andy. Pleasure to talk to the audience about this topic.
Yeah, very good. As you and your co-authors noted in this great review in stroke, atrial fibrillation obviously is highly prevalent, particularly among our older patients, as a leading cause of ischemic stroke. And I think it'd be helpful for our listeners if I was able to prompt you with several of these frequently encountered clinical scenarios that we often wrestle with, and just get your perspective based on what we know of the most up-to-date evidence, and then also in general, how you might handle some of these situations. So the first one is an important one, and if you're taking care of patients with stroke in the hospital, this is almost a daily or weekly question that comes to mind, which is, what is the optimal timing of initiating anticoagulation in patients who have atrial fibrillation following an ischemic stroke? And we'll touch on several aspects of this, but let's just sort of start off with that basic kind of optimal timing question, Seema.
Yeah, we don't have any clear-cut clinical trial data to answer that question as of now. There are some pragmatic tools and pragmatic suggestions which have been proposed. And for example, Dr. Chris Diener from Germany, he has espoused the 1-3-6-12 rule. And that rule indicates that if it's a TIA, that you start the anticoagulation without delay within 1 day. If it's a mild stroke defined as NIH score less than 8, then you start within 3 days, a moderate stroke within 6 days. And then if it's a severe stroke, you wait at least 12 days and reevaluate and see if the patient is safe for starting anticoagulation at that time. And this is a tool that I've used in recent years, and I think it's been quite useful in terms of guiding us, because we want to always strike a balance between avoiding recurrent embolic events, yet at the same time, we don't want to cause hemorrhagic transformation. And so I found this tool to be useful. But while we're waiting, there are some trials in progress, and some of them may provide us some data within the next year or so. One is called the ELON trial, and that is randomizing patients to starting direct oral anticoagulants or DOACs sooner versus later. And in most of these trials, early initiation means within about 2 to 4 days compared to later initiation, which is typically greater than 7 days.
That's great, Simon. And obviously, we'll look forward to having some more definitive data. But I think you're right. Most of us rely sort of on that thumb rule based on sort of the size of the infarct and the timing, weighing the risk of recurrent stroke versus the risk of hemorrhagic conversion. And so I find those sort of rubrics of timing based on size of infarct to be helpful in the meantime as well. So you mentioned DOACs, and I suspect that most of our listeners, certainly folks like you and me in the field of vascular neurology, have landed on the DOACs, or direct acting oral anticoagulants, as our first line treatment of choice for starting patients on anticoagulation and AFib. Can you just address that particular aspect, sort of the choice of anticoagulation in these patients at high risk for stroke with atrial fibrillation? And are there any additional caveats or scenarios that one should consider?
Sure. Yeah, so as the most clinicians know, we have the option of using vitamin K antagonists such as warfarin or the direct oral anticoagulants. And in recent years, there's been a significant shift toward use of the DOACs for long-term stroke prevention with AFib. And that's because of several advantages, including fewer drug interactions, early onset of activity, and no need for routine monitoring. And so for patients who are getting DOACs, it is recommended that you check the renal function at least once a year. But the early mechanism of action is very useful, because if you're trying to discharge a patient from the hospital, you know that soon after they take the oral medication, within a few hours, they can be effectively anticoagulated. And so this, instead of having to wait 3 to 5 days for patients to get in the therapeutic range, we can anticoagulate patients quickly and effectively. And so that's really why DOACs are now becoming the lion's share of the prescriptions for patients for long-term stroke prevention with AFib.
When you choose one of these, do you think of one as being preferred over the others as far as the DOACs go? What is your sense of the broad range of choice when it comes to the comparative effectiveness of these DOACs?
Yeah, each of them has some potential advantages and disadvantages. In terms of apixaban, I think apixaban is probably most widely used at the current time. And one of the reasons is that it was shown to have less bleeding compared to warfarin, as well as lower overall mortality. For dabigatran, which is a direct thrombin inhibitor, the 150 milligram dose actually showed greater superiority compared to warfarin relative to the other agents. And rivaroxaban also has some particular advantages, including once a day as opposed to twice a day dosing. And so if you're concerned about patient compliance, and especially if the patient is on numerous medications, the once a day formulation of rivaroxaban could be appealing. And so also, if the patient has renal failure, there's a little bit more data to support the use of apixaban compared to the other medications. But these are some of the factors that we consider in terms of making a selection among the medications.
And Seema, what about the scenario where a patient who is already on one of these medications or on vitamin K antagonist warfarin, when they come in with a new ischemic stroke on one of the meds? I know it's always enticing to think about switching to a different one. It's always a conversation worth having amongst your colleagues, you know, as well as with patients and their families. You know, how should we be approaching that conundrum when someone is ostensibly doing everything they can on the right medicine, but yet they have an ischemic stroke?
Yeah, the first step, I think, would be to take a step back and see what is the mechanism of the recurrent event. And are you sure it's embolic, or could there be some other mechanism, such as small vessel disease, playing a role in the recurring event? Also, it's useful to consider the broader landscape of there. Is there something new going on, such as an occult malignancy, which may be causing a hypercoagulable state, and maybe that's why the patient has had a recurrent event. But if you're convinced that it's a sort of routine embolic event due to atrial fibrillation, then I think there's no direct evidence-based reason to switch to another medication. But if you think that a couple of practical points could be that you may want to try a medication of a different mechanism of action, for example, if they failed a 10A inhibitor, it may make sense to try a direct thrombin inhibitor instead. Or if they failed a 10A inhibitor, and if you're concerned about patient compliance, then maybe the once-a-day option of rivaroxaban makes sense. And so these are some of the practical considerations to keep in mind. But the short answer is we don't have any clear, direct, evidence-based answer that switching will be useful for the long run.
And of course, we know that, you know, despite our hopes, these medicines, none of these medicines are 100% effective, despite them being one of the most effective medical treatments we have at our disposal for stroke prevention. But that is always a frustrating situation to encounter. So I appreciate your insights there. And Simon, I feel like that I know personally, and I'm sure others as well, are seeing more and more patients who have pursued or received atrial appendage exclusion with, you know, the Watchman device being probably the most common commercially available approach to this. Just for our listeners, can we comment just a moment on the situations in which one might refer a patient for left atrial appendage exclusion?
Yeah, if you have an AFib patient who requires long-term anticoagulation, but they're a suboptimal anticoagulation candidate for a variety of reasons, then we would consider left atrial appendage exclusion. And that can be done either with the Watchman device or, interestingly, just in the New England Journal, there's a paper on surgical exclusion at the time of patients undergoing cardiac surgery. And that also reduced the long-term stroke rate. So the patients who we would consider that are those who have either recurring GI bleeds, patients with cerebral amyloid angiopathy, perhaps patients who have severe white matter ischemic change, which can also be associated with a higher risk of cerebral hemorrhage, patients in whom they have a bleeding risk for other reasons, such as severe frailty. But so those are some of the common indications for the consideration of a left atrial appendage occlusion.
Well, and thanks for that sort of timely mention on the paper that just came out of New England Journal of Medicine, of course, which will precede the posting of this podcast. So we'll encourage our listeners to check that out as well. But that's very interesting to hear. Simon, I want to switch gears now and talk about another challenging decision point in managing patients who you're concerned could potentially have AFib but present with an embolic appearing stroke of undetermined source, or what used to be called, and many still call, cryptogenic strokes. What are you currently recommending? What does our evidence tell us about the best approach to ruling out paroxysmal atrial fibrillation in this patient population?
Yeah, the whole issue of screening for AFib has really exploded in recent years because of the proliferation of new devices. And if we go back about 7 years ago, there were a couple of large-scale trials which showed the benefit of screening in patients who have cryptogenic stroke. And those trials used either an external device such as a loop recorder or an implantable cardiac monitor. And the general principle is that the more you look for AFib, the more you'll find. And so that's not surprising, but if you leave a permanently implanted device in for 2 or 3 years, you're more likely to find AFib than if you use a 2-week monitor or a 4-week monitor. But the question has always been that which of the patients really deserve the long-term cardiac monitor. And so recently it's expanded from patients with cryptogenic stroke, and we now have some new data that even patients with stroke of other mechanism, such as small vessel disease or large vessel atherosclerosis, some of those patients also harbor a pretty significant risk of AFib in the range of 12 to 13% if you place an implantable device. And so this is really forcing us to re-examine our concepts here, that do we want to detect AFib because it's the cause of the stroke, or do we want to detect AFib because over the lifespan of the patient, it may arise later, and putting them on anticoagulation could prevent an embolic stroke in the future. And so these are all pretty new data, and so the stroke community is wrestling with this and how to adequately identify the patients who are the most prone to AFib and the most deserving of having implanted devices placed. On the other end of the spectrum, we also have wearable watches or ECG devices, which the patients can record for 2 minutes a day. Those can potentially detect AFib. But some of the watches have limited accuracy. And for example, in one study, out of all the patients who got a notification, only about one third were later confirmed to be AFib. And so if you, from the public health perspective, that may not be that bad, but from the individual patient perspective, it wasn't extremely accurate. And so these are some of the issues that we're dealing with. I'm working with some colleagues to look at the use of potential utility of genetic screening, because we know that there are greater than 90 loci which have been linked with AFib. And so if you have people who are genetically at high risk of developing AFib, it may be that those are the ones who would really benefit from having an implanted device put in their chest.
That is very interesting, Simon. And I do feel like this has been and will continue to be a bit of a moving target for us in the vascular neurology community. It is interesting to think about, you know, having both risk prediction tools that are based on clinical characteristics and demographic characteristics, but also potentially having, you know, biomarker or biopanel, genetically based or otherwise, that can help us identify folks that may be enriched for discovering AFib and in whom prophylactic anticoagulation may be of most benefit. So we'll look forward to more from that work as well. So lastly, just sort of to wrap it up here, maybe we'll touch on just briefly one additional aspect of your review that folks may not be as familiar with, which is a potential connection between AFib and vascular dementia. This is a hot topic, connecting what we understand about stroke to what we need to hopefully better understand about dementia and cognitive aspects of neurology to lead to better treatments and so forth. Can you just comment briefly, Simon, on this connection between AFib and vascular dementia?
Yes. In many longitudinal studies, it's been found that individuals who have AFib also have higher risk of cognitive impairment. And there's been a lot of debate as to whether AFib is an innocent bystander or is it a villain in terms of causing the brain injury and potentially dementia. And in terms of the bystander theory, we know that there are many vascular risk factors which increase your risk of AFib. And those include hypertension, diabetes, congestive heart failure, obesity, et cetera, sleep apnea. And so all of those are potentially hazardous for the brain. And so maybe it's not necessarily the AFib, but it's a constellation of those risk factors, which is increasing the risk of either small vessel disease or occult embolic events to the brain, and thus increasing the risk of vascular dementia. On the other hand, in terms of the villain theory, we do see patients who have AFib, and when we do CAT scans or MRIs, we see evidence of previous cortical embolic infarcts. And many times the patient had no symptoms. And so this is especially prevalent in the right hemisphere. In these patients, they could be having embolic events that the patient may not be aware of, and it's not detected until an imaging study is done. And so I think it's a combination of these factors, and it's likely multifactorial, but studies have shown that patients with AFib had about 1.5 to 2 times higher risk of dementia. And some studies have shown that with use of anticoagulants, there was about a 60% lower risk of dementia compared to patients who weren't on anticoagulants.
Well, that is an interesting note and really not a natural connection that people may make on the surface. But once you hear it explained and think about some of the biological and pathological basis of it, it makes sense. And so I no doubt there'll be more to come on this, as it is a topic of great interest in both the vascular neurology world as well as the cognitive neurology world. So Simon, I think those are all of my questions. This has been very helpful. I'm sure our listeners would agree. Any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Yeah, just two final thoughts. One, I want to acknowledge my co-authors, especially Dr. DeMarchis, who was the first author on the paper. And then secondly, our colleagues in the cardiology community, they've really embraced the ABC approach for AFib. And A stands for avoiding stroke with anticoagulation. B is better symptom control in terms of rate control and rhythm control. And then C is addressing cardiovascular comorbidities, such as obesity, as well as congestive heart failure. And so I think using this holistic ABC approach is a good way for neurologists to think about it also, and to help us work on the local level with our cardiology colleagues to try to strive to have best outcomes for our AFib patients.
Well, there you go. As we wrap up this fruitful discussion of AFib and stroke, just everybody remember your ABCs, and hopefully we'll all go forward and do our best to further decrease the burden of stroke related to AFib. So Simon, again, thank you for joining us. I'll encourage our listeners again to seek out the full article published in the Journal of Stroke, the April 2021 edition, New Avenues for Optimal Treatment of AFib and Stroke Prevention. Thanks again, Simon.
Thank you. Pleasure to join you.
This is Jose Merino. Don't forget to check out Neurology's three subspecialty journals, Neurology Genetics, Neurology Neuroimmunology and Inflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice, as well as our mini-sites on equity, diversity, and inclusion, global neurology, and innovations in care delivery. Also, please check out this week's journal, which features an article examining the long-term effects of deep brain stimulation on the motor complications in patients with Parkinson's disease, and a study investigating how protocols to determine death by neurologic criteria vary across pediatric hospitals throughout the United States. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.